You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this episode is Lavelle Brown. Lavelle, it's good to have you here this morning.
Excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, the way we start the show is with a big question.
Yeah.
Who are you? What do we need to know about the traits you aspire to, the experiences you've had, your roles, to start the conversation? Who are you?
Right. Well, I'm the son of Lucille and Babby Brown, two amazing people. I'm sure we'll talk about some. They live in Central Virginia, a little small town about a few minutes outside of Charlottesville, a rural town. So I'm their son. I'm very proud of them. And they, all that I am is because of the modeling they provided to me. And secondly, I'm a father, the proud daddy of Landon and Aiden Brown. Landon is 7 and Aiden will be 6 in a few weeks. They're my heart. And I do a lot of things for fun. In addition to being a proud son and a proud father, I have fun on the side. And one of the things I do for fun is I serve as superintendent of schools here in our great Ithaca, New York.
Are you trying to tell me that work is play?
Oh, work is play. I'm engaged in it. So it's not like work for me, quite frankly. It's just what I do for fun.
And how long have you been in Ithaca?
Almost 7 years now. Came in 2010-11, right there in January 11.
Mm-hmm. So we're gonna unpack what some of those roles mean, including the play, as we go forward. You brought some music. You wanted to open with Michael Jackson, Human Nature. Do you want to say anything about that, or just let the music?
Let me, you know, this is my first introduction to love for music. My father gave my brother and I have a twin brother. We were about 8, 9 years old. He gave us for Christmas the boombox.
Right.
And instead of playing rap music and giving us a rap CD at the time, which we grew to love, he gave us Michael Jackson's Thriller, which was brand new at the time. And we played that thing so much, it ended up breaking a few times, the tape, we rewinded it, and every cut on that album, which is one of the greatest of all time, was awesome, but Human Nature touched both of our hearts, and this is when I knew I was going to love music.
Here you go.
Reaching out, I touch her shoulder.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Lavelle Brown. So, Lavelle, you are from Charlottesville, or near Charlottesville.
Yeah, yes, yes.
And you talked about your parents and mm-hmm. your kids and mm-hmm. your role. Given the life that you value now, mm-hmm. looking back, what were the experiences that made you learn, this is the life I need to live? Mm-hmm.
Every day, I watched and learned my mom and dad and the way they loved people and the way they modeled love, their unselfishness, their trustworthiness, their truthfulness, their dedication. We didn't have a lot of money. We had a lot of love there, and they modeled that for us every day. And they also modeled this notion of diversity and inclusion. They sought to bring folks from different backgrounds and belief systems into our lives and help us understand how that enriched our lives. Mm-hmm. So from an early age, and I tell the story often, you know, the first time I was hit with this notion of inclusion and inclusive environments was at church. We were in church often. And it was a African-American Southern Baptist church. We had a fun time, and we grew there. And I remember being 8 or 9 years old in church, you know, all of my friends and family, all the only folks we really knew, and a white couple walked in. And I remember how uncomfortable my brother and I were when we saw these folks who looked different than us, who weren't part of our social group, who we thought believed different things than we believed. And, you know, we talked to one another in the pew about how they shouldn't be there and what we were going to do to make them uncomfortable. Uh-huh. And my mom and dad heard it. And I remember how they checked us in a loving way. They didn't yell. They weren't mean, but they used that as an opportunity to teach us about why it was important for folks from different backgrounds and races and with socioeconomic status to be together and learn and love together. Mm-hmm. And that day, we talked about it for weeks. They helped
so this
us.
Was in the late. This was, how old were you?
I was 8, 9 years old.
So this was after you got this audio.
Yeah, after I got this audio. Yeah, and they helped me understand it. And that's just one of many examples of how they modeled how to love people, and it's helped me now today. And I see oftentimes too, my mom and dad raised us not to be revolutionaries and to break down systems and yell at people. They, instead of yelling at the man, they raised us to be the man, per se, in a way of speaking. So they've taught us how to change systems, change policies, advocate on behalf of all people.
Right, I guess. And when you are raised to be, in a mm-hmm. sense, the man, mm-hmm. And my assumption is that they accepted the fact that their lives were contradictions.
Yeah.
And that when you are, quote, the man, mm-hmm. you have to live some paradoxes or hypocrisies or contradictions mm-hmm. that cannot be resolved in your lifetime and may never be right. resolved. Mm-hmm. How did they model for you the acceptance of the challenge mm-hmm. without getting yeah. bitter or without pushing triumphalism?
Yeah, my mother spent 46 years in a classroom as a teacher's aide, at one point making $4,000 a year. My father drove a 18-wheeler for 46 years for Anheuser-Busch. He delivered beer to he built the University of Virginia because he delivered beer to those dorms and fraternities for 40-plus years. And, you know, much of his career, he was not allowed to step foot on the campus or on the lawn, the prestigious lawn at the University of Virginia. And, you know, he still delivered beer. He still made he earned money. He took care of his family with that job. But I think every day he did that, he realized, you know, I may not be able to be on this campus because of the way I look. But my children are going to go here and they're going to achieve here. And he and my mother would work to make sure we were in the right classes. They would work to make sure we were prepared academically, socially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his son, me, I went to the University of Virginia for free, graduated 4 different times, one of the most decorated students in the history of that school. And it's something he's very, very proud of. And I see, and when we talk now, I realize that he was living in a world that didn't welcome him on ground for a long time. Yet he raised a son who not only stepped foot on the ground, but achieved more so than any other student ever there. And in the policy shift that needed to occur, the mindset shift that needed to occur along the way, he and my mother were part of building.
Right, right. How did he, what was his personality like that he could either check or did not experience the bitterness that can lash out? What about him allowed that?
Yeah, he's again, we go back to those principles of love. He's forgiving and he's humble. If you truly love, you forgive. And I know I struggle with this every day. It's why I'm in a good mood all the time, because I oftentimes struggle to deal with the things that I feel have been wrong.
Right.
And he not only understood them, tackled them, but he forgave people and systems. And he was humble. He knew that we were all learning. We were all learning together. So that humbleness, along with his ability to forgive, and I'm trying to be better and better about that every day, allowed him to not be bitter and to be angry or to give up. It actually kept him in this place where he was a lifelong learner,
right?
And
right.
Loving people.
Is he still alive?
Yeah, he is. They're about 80 years old. They're going to be driving up to Ithaca this weekend to see me for my birthday.
Oh, neat. When is your birthday?
September the 6th, the first day of school. One of those cool things. My birthday was always the first day of school. So those new shoes and new clothes you would get for school was always your birthday present
right,
at the same time.
Doing double duty.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So your mother was a teacher's aide for 45 years.
Yeah.
How did she was that because she didn't have the education or because she couldn't get the job as a full teacher?
It's all about education and systems and structures. I say she's taught thousands of young people how to read, but because she didn't have a college degree, she was never a certificated teacher,
right.
Which kept her from making those additional dollars. And, you know, my father didn't complete high school because he pushed me today. Why school? He's pushed me with that type of thinking. You know, most recently we have folks come into our town and dispute hate, say mean things. All those folks had high school diplomas, college degrees, were CEOs of companies based on their certifications.
Right.
And, you know, my dad asked me, you know, so if those folks have degrees and they still hate, what's the purpose of school? And, you know, his son is one international educational leader. Having to respond to that question, I've struggled with it. And I'm still grappling with it. So, again, my parents, again, some of the most brilliant people I've ever known, because of the time and systems and structures, didn't have those degrees. But they've navigated systems unlike any other.
Right. Mm-hmm. And we have a slight similarity. Mm-hmm. My parents were both offered scholarships to college, but for reasons they were not allowed by their parents to use them.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, they had 8 children on a subsistence farm in Northwest Missouri. And all 8, one child died shortly after birth, but all 7 of us have gone to college. 2 of us have doctorates. 5 of us have other graduate degrees. That was the push, but they never had anything.
Mm.
Financially much. And Dad died at 45 and leaving Mom with 3 sons to raise, having raised 4 daughters before us. So the point is that they poured their loss into our hope.
Yeah.
And that has enduring consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a new level of unselfishness.
Yeah, yeah, and when she and Mom could be the assistant librarian in the school for a brief time after she was a nurse's aide, but she couldn't be the librarian because she had no college, and she couldn't. And at the nursing home, she could be the assistant activity director, but she couldn't be the activity director because she had no college, and that's how she managed to get us on after the farm was no longer viable when Dad died. So you talked about how you learned from them, but how do you manage when do you find yourself reacting and how do you check yourself?
I'm reacting, you know, in these past few weeks I've had many conversations with them and I'm helping them come to grips with what's happening in our town. I pull from my core beliefs around love, those key principles. I use those to give me strength. I'm a spiritual person too. I pray a lot. I ask for strength and wisdom. I read much. So through reflection, self-reflection, and going back to staying true to my core values, I'm able to see things clearly, more clear, right. And sort through some very complex, tough situations. So again, yeah, and it's working with people, but going back to my core values and using self-reflection quite a bit.
So you've alluded to Charlottesville, mm-hmm. but you've also alluded to here in Ithaca, mm-hmm. and you are in the process of rolling out a program, Lead with Love,
yeah,
or Leading with Love, if I got that correctly. Mm-hmm. I want to jump to that, but I'd like to take just a moment. What music should we go to next here?
Oh, we've talked about college a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's go to that Cheryl Lynn Encore, 1984, as that was the moment I knew I was going to go to college. My sister was at GMU, the first persons in our family to go to college. I remember her coming back home.
She must have been a good bit older than
me. A little bit older, 10 years older. And we were young. And I'm listening to Michael Jackson, and she came home and played this Cheryl Lynn song and talked about how it was playing at the parties and how much fun she was having at school. And that's when I knew I was going to college too.
Yep. Here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Lavelle Brown. So it was really striking when you said that in the aftermath of the violence in Charlottesville, that your father said, how could so many, what's the purpose of education when so many educated people can be so hateful? Mm-hmm. Educated, I would say, white people in that instance. My understanding is Leading with Love is a little bit of your response to that challenge.
Yeah, it is. And he's been asking me this question for a few years now. What's happening in our schools here in Ithaca is a national story. Folks in Virginia are talking about it. They're talking about it all over the nation. Our quantitative shifts when it comes to achievement metrics are the most remarkable in our country. The graduation rates soaring, co-curricular involvement, discipline down, attendance up. It's an amazing story. And when I go home, folks are celebrating it. They celebrate it here. And, you know, and my dad is always watching, and you know, he keeps me humble, and he pushes me like, so those are due goals, and due goals are goals that change as you achieve them. We started out here at 78% graduation rates. We said we wanted to get to 90, and that was aspirational. We thought it would take 10, 15 years of work, and we're well beyond that now. And now our board and I and the community wants 100%. So due goals change, but be goals, be, and who you are, your core values, that never changes. And so a few years ago, we said, yeah, we'll be the best school district in the nation when it comes to achievement and metrics. But we also want to be one where folks come and they feel loved. And this culture that we build and cultivate here is going to be love. It's going to be dedicated, truthful, forgiving, unselfish, humble. That's where I'm going to spend the rest of my career. And hopefully it's here. Where we are building this type of culture, because we have a school district that is known for that more so than what achievement numbers we produce. We have changed the world. We've changed the community. We've saved lives. So this leading with love is us as a community focusing on those B goals. In addition, because, you know, as we nail down who we are and who we're going to be, the achievement metrics and the do goals take care of themselves. We're about to start school next week. And when our young people walk through those doors, they will know that a community is here to support them and support them in a loving way. That's what this walk is about. Folks from all aspects of the community, different backgrounds, belief systems, are going to be there to show that we're here to support our young people. And we aren't reacting to anything. We are in a proactive way building a culture that can respond to anything.
Right. And the walk is when?
The walk will be Wednesday morning, 7:30 a.m. We're going to meet at Stewart Park, and we're going to walk to Ithaca High School. That's the large part of the walk, but throughout our community and the other schools, everyone's going to be doing something on that day that shows our support for young people. And, you know, that time is the one we had to choose because of a lot of logistics. But that day is a day where we are going to be leading with love as we open our school doors to the young people in our community.
And so one of the challenges, and this is it's always a little tricky with values, because sometimes maybe the values don't change, but our understanding of them changes 180 degrees. So it's always kind of an open question: did the values change or did we change? You know. But the, and I also grew up in a community where it was kind of understood that even your enemy needed what it takes to thrive, and you could never deprive, and I'm going to use the language they use then, you could never deprive a man of what he needed to thrive, or else you would make the whole community the less for it. And you could be at opposite ends in terms of values or politics or whatever, but you needed to see that people got access to resources. So there'd be a person who was mentally ill who would, he and his brother lived in isolation off in the woods, which happened a lot back in those days. But he would always, people would give him a ride. But if he got too upset, he would accidentally go to the bathroom in the truck. And so they didn't want him necessarily riding in the front of the car or in the truck. So he'd sit in the back. But that actually allowed him to calm down. But they had to get used to the fact that he's their equal. But he's also not, he needs to be treated differently because he has needs that are different. So he would go in and do his shopping and stuff with the money that he had from the farm. So there was a really awkward learning, because the lessons you're talking about learning are awkward. Sometimes they smell because we take care of our bodily functions differently. Sometimes they are awkward because people value things in different ways and you just don't get it. How could you say that to her or him or do that or whatever? How is the school district actually engaging these awkward moments so that you can live the value of love?
I mean, that's where I see our work as being so critical right now in my role, quite frankly, in leading these conversations. School is a place for, it has to be a safe place, first of all, and it has to be a safe place that cultivates thinking. Yes, those values are going to be here. We're going to work on those every day. And the another common denominator is the ability to think, seeing different perspectives, analyzing complex information, evaluating, synthesizing. That's what we're here to do. And when thinking and taking on different perspectives and evaluating in that way, we'll have a common mental model around those values, a more common mental model.
Or we'll have a conversation.
And a conversation, yes. Yeah,
uh-huh. Which we may not share, but we're engaged.
Yeah, engaged. And we're thinking about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess, part of it is an animal that is completely safe is not alert. Mm. They're not stimulated enough to keep a watch over what may be important. So you want an environment to be safe enough, mm. but not so safe that you're kind of asleep at the wheel. And you want it to be challenging enough, unsafe enough, that you're alert to all sorts of things and engaging them, but not to the point where you are frozen or reactive, just completely reacting, out of control. Mm-hmm. How do you cultivate that space, that sweet space, mm-hmm. where things happen?
And we're talking a lot about, and thanks for pushing my thinking on this. The safety for us is the willingness to engage in conflict or discourse. To change the world, to do the kind of things we're talking about doing, there needs to be some conflict. And, you know, quite frankly, in education,
there's plenty going around.
Yeah, but in educational spaces, we are conflict averse. We don't like for to be in conversations that are uncomfortable. We don't like to push folks to a place, tell folks they aren't excellent, to say to folks that we're not doing a good job. So we are engaging in conflict and hoping to engage in more conflict that's safe. So having safety that we can engage in this conversation, right. And be trusting of one another and forgiving, and there will be no hurt feelings, and it won't affect our relationship. But it's the conflict and the ideas must be different enough to move forward.
Right. And we're going to hurt each other.
Yeah.
And the issue is there won't be enduring hurt, or there won't be the cultivation of bitterness, which I was talking about in terms of your parents. How did they engage the conflict without becoming bitter? Right, right. Because their aspirations were completely out of sync with what they could achieve.
Mm-hmm.
But you're doing it.
Yeah. That's
my good part of it.
That's my
and
life.
He's still
work.
Challenging you,
and he's still challenging me right now. And it's going to be my life's work. The schools, the world that my two kids are going to grow up in and have to operate in, is so different from the one I've had to navigate, and the one I've navigated is so different from the one my father had to navigate. So I see myself being him now. I'm turning into my dad,
right.
With my own kids and building, helping them figure out how to navigate these complex systems. Because quite frankly, I don't know if school's going to exist in 30, 40 years. I don't know if this role of as superintendent that I'm in will exist. If we do our jobs well, I know it won't exist.
Right.
These are antiquated systems. I feel like education, schools are the blockbuster of my industry right now. We're quickly becoming obsolete,
right.
And antiquated. So my kids are going to need to navigate systems that look like schools not being there.
Right. So, schools are built on a factory model. I mean, they come out of a 19th century notion and everybody is segregated by age as opposed to skill or interest. And, and they're primarily focused on learning testable issues rather than the more holistic character or value issues that you're raising, which involve people seeing somebody from 360 degrees, which means old people and people who are younger and people who are different, so that the person becomes stronger from all those different points of view. Mm-hmm. You can't do that in a grade segregated public school.
You get it.
Yeah, I get it. I've gotten it for 20 or 30 years, yeah. But I don't know how to. So what is this process by which we fly a plane while we decide that the technology is not working and reinvent it? How do we make the kind of transition that you're alluding to?
And then, you know, we've talked about self-reflection, we've talked about conflict, and that third thing that we must now face is policy shifts. policies are why we have achievement gaps. We have the issues we have in schools right now. Policies have been on the books for decades that contribute to the type of systems and results we're getting. Mm-hmm. Now, to change the systems and structures, we'll need different policies.
Right.
And if those policies are looked at from a place of love, that represent diversity and inclusive environments, those policies are going to shift, and we're going to get structures more like the ones you and I were just talking about are different. So now it's the conversation now are about policies. And, you know, in Ithaca, we have Sean Everything Bradwell, who's leading our policy work, who's changing every policy in our manual through that lens, and we're seeing structures and systems shift. That's next. Now, we know how hard the bureaucracies that exist that are preventing us from changing policies, the deep rooted philosophical beliefs that exist amongst adults are preventing policies from being shifted. But that's what has to happen if we want to change.
And I guess what you're helping me to think about, and part of I'm working on a project with my partner, which is bumping up into these topics as well. Most of education has rewarded people who get the right answer and punished those who get the wrong answer. So you end up rewarding success and punishing failure. But if you want to create a lifelong learner, you reward failure when they use it to come around the second time. Yeah. And you don't focus on success because that's for now and that's the past and we're going to need to move into the future. Mm-hmm. So, it's a fundamental shifting of incentives.
Yeah. And that's why we say it's more important to focus on the question. If you can look up the answer, it's a bad question. If you can't look up the answer, it's a decent question. So it's more important to be able to ask good questions than it is to find an answer.
Right. But you also cannot grade with a formula a good answer under your rubric.
Yeah. And that's the next big thing for us as educators to take on. I'm opposed to grading. I say that as the education leader of our school district. I think when you give A, B, C's, B's enough, at best you're going to get strategic compliance. We say to folks, and I'm wanting this kind of shift to happen in our classrooms and with policies, everyone gets an A. If that's what we have to do to meet the needs of colleges and transcripts, everyone gets an A. Now let's get to the real conversations. Grading is what I feel like has led to the downfall of my industry right now is when folks feel like they have to give a numerical number to a young person's thinking. If we set up a system that results in a number, we've set up the wrong system. If we're trying to put a number on one's thinking, it's an inappropriate approach to it. But I know that's a very unpopular thing to say.
Right.
In a town where Cornell University exists and come from a town where the University of Virginia is, to say that I don't agree with A's and B's and sorting and selecting that way is not popular.
Well, but it also means, but you're also saying, I realize that we have to do this pragmatically because we have to help kids make it to the next step in the world that is now. Yeah. But the future is not going
to
be that
way. We have to do it to sort and select.
Yeah. And I have said on this show more than once that I had, when I went to seminary, Union Seminary in New York City, I had faculty, one out of two, who were deeply critical and analytical thinkers, and they would be as sharply tearing apart their own stuff and yours and encouraging you to do the same. I had maybe one out of four professors at Cornell, and I have an undergraduate degree as a college scholar from Cornell and a PhD from Cornell. And one of the big differences between those two institutions, at Union Seminary, they gave no grades. It was pass, fail, or if you were way out beyond it was with distinction. And so what they did at the end of every course was you got a summary of their assessment of what you walked into the course with, what you did with the course, and what you walked out from the course with. It was a narrative summary. And it was a mixture of content and character. All in that analysis.
And what you're describing, we're light years away as far as policy, bureaucratic structures, belief systems. But I think everyone would agree that what you described is what is best for young people.
Right, and no learners. And no one faculty person would get the student fairly or right. It's not about rigid accuracy. It's about learning to deal with other people's assessments of yourself. And then when it got time for a doctoral program after you did the MDiv, there would be a summary of all of those evaluations that would be written by a fellow who was considered the wisest and most respected professor that would then go into your file to wherever you applied for doctoral work.
Wow, that felt...
Yeah, but I had never made that connection. We looked at each other, we saw each other in competition and in support of each other in a different way because I think of the incentive structure. And I had never made that connection. I'm rambling.
Sounds good.
So as an educator, we just described something that I have been thinking about for years, but you helped me put it in concrete terms. How can you help make the story so that other people can tell their own stories locally in concrete terms that can move your agenda forward? What are the stories people are going to need to tell each other locally about achievement and how you assess it and how you reward it?
It's going to start with folks before they get to their story being self-reflective. And understand a deep understanding of when they learned best, when they were most engaged, when they were most connected to an adult in school. And I've asked that question of thousands of people throughout my career. And every time I ask that question, folks have an answer. And it's that favorite teacher, that favorite class. And rarely does that class or teacher involve some type of numerical grade.
Right.
It's about the relationship. It's about what they learned, how they were engaged, et cetera.
And it's not the technical content. It's that the content happened in the context of the relationship.
It was an interdisciplinary approach to whatever. They solved a real-world problem. Yeah. The work was meaningful. It was challenging. They became frustrated and emotional. See, and that's what we're building out in our curriculum now. One of the most exciting things happening in our school district is this approach to project-based learning and case studies, where we're putting young people in these interdisciplinary approaches to teaching and learning, where they're solving real-world problems that are relevant to their school communities, where they're not worried about the assessment per se. They're worried about what they're learning and how they're engaging and collaborating with young people from different backgrounds in their classes. Those examples our young people are generating right now for themselves. Everyone you talk to has an example like that from their school experience. So folks are going to need to speak to that as the norm instead of it being the outlying example or the exception. When we get there, we've made it. We're getting closer to the model. So folks are going to need to pull on their own experiences to provide examples of what it should be and couldn't be.
And who do you need to collaborate on these projects? Mm-hmm. And how do you pull kids and community members into that?
Yeah, and you just said it. Our projects and our case studies involve the community. We're engaging community experts. We're engaging parents, schools, across schools, across classrooms. It's going to be a community. It has to be a community-wide effort where we're all seen as learners. We're quickly shifting from this notion of a teacher and a student to everyone's a learner, and we're working on things and growing and learning and solving problems together. Becoming a parent has been the best thing for me as far as a professional and as a person, but I'm seeing now how smart and thoughtful young people can be at such an early age since they were born, but now, especially now, it's 5 and 6 year olds. My kids are thinking at levels I couldn't have imagined, and they're processing things that I can't process. When I get out of the way, when I allow them the freedom to do those things, I learn from them, and they teach me.
I had the privilege to provide supplemental programming in the Spencer Bennett Middle School from 2007 to 2013. And we wanted we wanted kids to go to the Museum of the Earth. We wanted Darwin Days. But we also wanted to honor the fact that there is a small but significant religious community there. So we were teaching Genesis and the Origin of Species next to each other, which you can do. There's no law against it. And we brought in scientists from Cornell to help with the evolutionary aspects of it and the science-based piece. But there also happened to be either non-religious or Jewish or Muslim or Christian. And we would get these conversations going about how these texts are different and what constitutes evidence given the text that you're looking at. and how would you use evidence that's appropriate for the text that you're working with. And you need skill to work with a religious text, even if you're not religious, because other people are. You need skill with a scientific text, whether you care about science or not, because that's one of the things we're accountable to in this world. And what we got back from the parents in that school district was they were grateful that we were hitting this head on, whether they were secular, anti-religious in orientation, or whether they were evangelical Christian or liberal, moderate Christians, because they felt like finally we're hearing real voices in the school, and nobody's ashamed.
Yeah, you were pushing thinking. You were talking about differences, similarities, perspectives, relationships. That's what we do in schools. And when we do that well, young people create new knowledge.
Right. And it creates conversations at home. And one of the things that, I mean, we had one bookcase in the house I grew up in, but we had three sets of encyclopedias in that bookcase. And every one of us had largely read all three of them before we got out of that house. And we discussed them as a family, because that's part of what we did learning. Even though we were raising 2 acres of vegetables to can or put in the root cellar so we could eat through the winter. That's part of being part of a larger agenda. Families oftentimes, when you're live in a consumer society, families don't understand that their role isn't consumption, it's production. And how to make it move forward. And I think that if you can set up the learning environment in the school so that the parallel play that happens at home is learning. And I use that phrase strictly as it's meant. It's a process that's going to repeat itself, because that's what they know in one place and they'll do it in another.
We're creating and help cultivating good people and thoughtful people in our schools, and that translates into home environments as well.
What music should we play next?
We can continue to talk about my college experiences. So after knowing I wanted to go to college, after hearing my sister talk about it and her playing her music, I ended up in college at the University of Virginia. And this song right here, Outstanding by the Gap Band, was the song we played at every party. And it just takes me to a special place.
Here we go.
Yeah, you're looking sweet tonight. You got it every day, girl. Wish that I could love you right.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Lavelle Brown. So, Lavelle, the way I like to kind of close the show out for the last 10, 15 minutes is to talk about what you do to take care of yourself physically, emotionally, and intellectually. To me, those add up to spiritually, you know, in terms of pushing the buttons and stuff. Mm-hmm. And how do you know you need to do it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a routine, routine that's worked well for me, and it's working well for me, particularly now in this role I'm in. I wake up every morning early, around 5:15, 5:30, and I pray. I ask for wisdom and strength, I ask for protection, and it's worked for me. And I can feel a presence in my life every day. Folks will tell you I'm never in a bad mood. I'm always happy. I feel like I'm that way because of the strength that I'm given. And also, I wake up every day thanking God for being here. You know, part of my story is most of my friends, the folks that my brother and my twin brother and I grew up with, many of them are dead, having not survived the environments that we were in, as with not much money, a different educational system. So every day I wake up, I just thank God that I'm here, and then I ask for strength to be better every day, and that's working. And then I hit the gym. I like to stay in shape. It gives me that time to keep my head clear. I have an opportunity to work out with some amazing student athletes often. They bring me strength and peace. So I train every day. And then, you know, I hang out with my kids. When they're in school, when they're out of school, I learn from them every day. And they bring... The day my daughter was born, I say my life, not only did it change my life, the person I was died. I was, in many ways, a selfish person. All those love principles I speak about, I learned the true meaning of them the day she was born and I looked at her. And it happened again when my son was born. I'm a different person today than I was before I had them. And I'm honored to be their father. And also, it actually helped strengthen my belief systems in God. You know, I look at them and I see only something that perfect and that thoughtful could be created by God. You know what I mean? I didn't do that. And what they brought to my life, I know, was a gift from the person that I worship every day. So that's me. And I don't get a chance to talk about that much. And in my role, I'm probably not supposed to talk about it that much. But in this
but
setting,
you're not in your role right
I'm
now.
I'm not in that role right now. Yeah. So if people are wondering what pushes me. And I know folks, when they see me, I hope that they feel better after an interaction with me than they did before they started talking to me. And I hope, and they're probably wondering how I'm able to do this. I've done this. I mean, I was one of the younger superintendents in the nation for a while. This role is not hard. It's not easy. I'm saying it's a very hard role, and
But it's not unbearably.
It's not unbearably hard, and I use it as something. I'm serving a community in it. So, and all those things are able to happen because of my belief systems and the things I do to have fun.
I want to take you back to something you had said earlier, and when you have been raised by parents who know the risks that you're growing through, you can become an achievement junkie, or you can become filled with survivor's guilt. Where I came from, 1 out of 20 of my peers wouldn't make it to the age of 20. And because of drugs, fights with the police, bad health care, all sorts of stuff. I'm wondering if that road to achievement, which launched your career, got blown up on some level in terms of, or what happened? What died when your daughter was born?
What died, I mean, quite frankly, was the selfishness that I think I had. For me, it was all about achievement in career. Yeah. What degree would I get next? What job would I seek and hopefully land? How much money could I make? What type of suit could I buy? And I still like nice suits, but it was about me. When she was born, I realized that it wasn't not about me at all. And that me being on this planet was to serve young people, particularly her, and young people like her, and make this a better world for them. So with that was me focusing, you know, my love for young people, my love for my own children is so much bigger than my ego at this point. And that was not always the case. Mm-hmm. It was my ego probably a little bit more so than young people, and that's different.
And my son walked me through this. There's a difference between being egotistical, which is absorbed with yourself, mm-hmm. and being egoic, which is being aware of the ego and how its impact mm-hmm. is. Mm-hmm. And that is a powerful distinction. And yeah. you seem to have...
Yeah. You know, fortunately, this role, our successes, the role I'm in, I've had opportunities to be in places all over the world. And again, my love for my own children and the love for young people here in Ithaca will never allow me to leave, to choose to leave. Now, I don't know what happened tomorrow, but just, to, you know, there are rumors every day about where he's going, is he going to be here? And I laugh at them now. Mm-hmm. Like these folks, people who say those things have no idea who I am, and quite frankly, no idea about the level of commitment I have to my own children who love it here, and the young people that I've grown to love and watch grow up here as well.
Right, right. I'm going to speculate here that the struggles that matter when you're living in this more integrated and other-oriented way are struggles that are more personal, and they're less symbolic, and they aren't the kinds of things that generate a lot of headlines the conflicts that really matter are the conflicts that we live through face to face with our coworkers and mm-hmm. our community people and our kids, because they're the ones that test our character mm-hmm. and cause us to grow. Mm-hmm. So that will create a different environment for you in terms of how you telegraph this is working mm-hmm. to the wider community. That would be my guess.
Yeah, that's deep. But you, I mean, as I'm processing what you just said, if I'm hearing you correctly, my personal struggles, my day-to-day struggles, are much bigger than the work or the overall achievement.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not about the number of computers or the number of kids in AP courses. Mm-hmm. It's about the quality of engagement that's right. rippling down, that's cascading through right. the system and right. rippling yeah. across the community.
Yeah, I mean, there's a young man who's texting me right now, who I've watched grow up in this community, and quite frankly, he's one 10 years ago, probably because of just looking at statistics alone, he wouldn't have graduated from high school.
Right.
Now he's at a local university on a football team, and he's going for free, and he's probably one of the better students at that place right now. Mm-hmm. And I like to think that I had a significant part in many ways, saving his life.
Right.
Like someone saved mine.
Right.
That's the real work right there. Yeah. And no one would know. It's not something I would put out of the press release about. It's a one-to-one connection and effort to save one another. And that's the real work right now.
Right. And when you live that way, we have a part in each other's life. Mm-hmm. Even you and I have a part in each other's life, though you came mm-hmm. mostly after my kids were out of the system. And that also is how love works. Your fulfillment is in part dependent upon my supporting it, and my fulfillment is dependent in part upon your supporting it.
Yeah.
And we never have to fly a flag.
Mm-hmm. That's the beauty about what's happening here in Ithaca right now. We're positioned to do even more amazing things, but the community love that exists, it's working. We're changing our community. We're more loving. More and more of our young people are achieving. We're saving lives. And we have a lot of work yet to do. But I feel a different place. And this is the place I live in. I'm choosing to live in and raise my family. It feels different than it did when I first got here.
Yeah.
And I would say it's because of what you described. Folks coming together in ways that you can't necessarily capture in a story or a press release, but people are coming together and connecting.
And also not giving up conflicts that matter
mm-hmm.
because of some assumption that we have to be in lockstep. Yeah. Because community is where you care enough to fight with each other, but not destroy each other.
Yes. And if for, you know, I'm in a role where folks have loved to destroy the person in that role, not because of who they were, but because of the role itself.
And because of the lack of modeling about a good, fair fight.
Yeah. And I see that shifting. I feel that shifting.
Yeah.
And not, folks aren't always happy with me, and I'm not always happy with things that happen in our community, but
yeah.
We are in this thing together, and we're working and growing together. And from my perspective, that's shifted in my tenure here.
Yeah. I would say I feel it too, although I hadn't traced out those particular connections the way you have. Mm. Lavelle, it's been wonderful to get know you.
Yeah, it's been fun.
What should we close with?
Let's close with probably my favorite song of all time. And you know, it is 10 years ago at the 2007 halftime show at the Super Bowl. A guy performed Prince. He sang a song at the end of his segment there that was about 20 years old at the time. The song was 20 years old, but when he sang it and when he played, it was as if he had just launched it. And it started raining too. It's Purple Rain. It started raining. I don't know if folks remember that. And when I remember that moment, I'm like, yo, this guy stayed true to his values. This is a dream come true. This is how it should be as far as everything coming together, and it works. That's what's going to happen in our community. Purple Rain, halftime show, 2007, Super Bowl.
Thank you, Lavelle.
Yeah.
I never meant to cause you any trouble. I never meant to cause you any pain. I only wanted one time to see you laughing. You can't seem to make up your mind.